From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Brian Frosch. He is Maryland's attorney general, and we'll shortly be talking with Aubrey Lane Jr. He is Virginia's secretary of transportation. Got questions about I-66? Call now, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and ask a question, make a comment, or watch the live video stream of this broadcast there. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Welcome. Maybe some people stuck on I-66 can call because they have nothing to do.
Exactly right. They're on that parking lot right now, even though it's not right now rush hour. Crime is the number one issue in Washington, D.C. The Washington Post has been conducting a variety of polls, and that is one of them. This is different from 4 years ago when people thought that the economy was the major issue, and sometime before that when people thought that education was the major issue. It is now crime, and that's obviously the result of the spike in crime, and that's affected the mayor's ratings somewhat.
It's a spike in homicides, principally. Yes. There are a lot of crimes are down in many parts of the city. Robberies and those types of day-to-day crimes. But homicides are up in the city. It's gotten a lot of attention. The mayor has addressed it a lot. And so that's a tough thing. Part of the polling that has come out is that the mayor has suffered for some of that. She has a 60% approval, nearly 60% approval rating in the Washington Post poll. But 47% of the people who approve of her only approve of her somewhat, which is damning with kind praise. That's not a good thing. But and also the housing, homeless issues have undercut her. The bottom line for her is that she is okay at 60%, but the support seems soft, and it is less than what Adrian Fenty and Tony Williams had when they were mayors in their first year. So she's got some work to do to shore up her support.
And speaking of the crime issue, the police body camera program is advancing through the council in D.C. The chair of the committee that has been overseeing this issue, Kenyon McDuffie, has been involved in negotiations with the mayor, and it seems that they have come to some agreement. There was a lot of concern over whether or not the public would have access through FOIA to the video that was taken from police cameras, especially in cases where there were allegations of a police assault involved. At one point, it seemed that the mayor was not going to allow that video to be seen. As a result of these negotiations, that will happen. The mayor has apparently signed on to the proposal. Tell us a little bit more about it. And what's
I did
next.
A story about this, and the mayor proposed the legislation eight months ago, legislation that was much more restrictive on what kinds of video would be made available, not only to like the media, but to the people who themselves felt like they had been mistreated by the police. It was a rabbit warren of issues that would, you could do this, but you couldn't do that. You could do this, but you couldn't do that. Kenyon McDuffie had a much broader perspective on this, and so over the last 8 months, the mayor, Kevin Donahue, the deputy mayor of public safety, they met with the ACLU, the Fraternal Order of Police, the Open Records Organization, and several other groups, and they said, look, we've got to make this available. If we don't make the video available, it will go nowhere in easing the public's concern that the video cameras are doing anything at all. And the police union said, look, we've got to make this video available because we know it's going to show that 99% of the time the cops do a good job. Mm-hmm. So they've reached a bill that will be one of the most progressive and expansive in the country, Kenyon McDuffie told me yesterday, compared to anywhere else in the country. This in the cameras, the mayor's administration said to me that Michael Zinn said that they thought the cameras might be out on the street as early as March. The council still has to vote on it, but there's no real opposition.
Well, the council seems to favor it, the mayor seems to favor it, and those people in the public who require more access seem to favor it. But there's one important party who I have not consulted on whether there is sufficient access in this bill. Tom Sherwood.
Well, The paperwork says there's sufficient access. Whether the practice...
Well, you see everything you think you want to see as you have to make reports.
Right. And we should point out that there are legitimate concerns
about privacy.
The privacy of people involved in sexual abuse, domestic abuse inside of homes. There are cautionary restrictions there, but there are no roadblocks to the significant amount of video in the public. And I think that's a good thing. As a journalist, I hope that, you know, we don't know yet what it's going to cost, how quickly the video will be turned around. It will be probably a rough rollout, but the fact is we're going to do it in this city.
You are Mr. Transparency, so if it gets past Tom Sherwood, that means there's enough transparency in this legislation. Joining us now by phone is Aubrey Lane Jr. He is Virginia's Secretary of Transportation. Aubrey Lane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me today. Appreciate being on.
Let's go straight to I-66. One of the biggest disputes right now in Northern Virginia involves I-66 inside the Beltway. It's an important route for a lot of commuters and a very congested one. Many people rely on it to commute in and out of D.C. into Northern Virginia. What plans are in the works to address congestion on that route, and why is it so controversial?
Well, let me first start by saying that this 10 miles of interstate is unlike no other in the country, in that since its very inception, it's been restricted only to HOV usage. When you combine that with the limitations, anybody that's driven it knows there's very little room for expansion. It makes difficult, as you pointed out, there's quite a few people that use the road every day. But again, I should point out before I say what's in the works that only during peak rush hours is only allowed for HOV usage. Today, solo drivers are not supposed to use the road. Now, we know quite a few of those do, we know there's some obviously some abuse of the system, but the restrictions of the road make it difficult to enhance enforcement. So what we have planned is to offer an option for single drivers who now are prohibited from using that road during rush hour to implement tolling. If you're an HOV a driver, you're not impacted by this plan. But if you are a solo, you now have the option to pay a toll, which would be based on dynamic pricing. And we can talk about, I know a lot of rhetoric in the election about the amount of the tolls. But you can pay an option, your choice to use this road. We actually think that will help to pay for enhanced bus service, multimodal options, both on this road and others in the corridor. That's what the money's going to be used for, to enhance driving inside the Beltway on 66, also to coordinate with our plans for outside the Beltway that we should be making decisions on fairly soon. And this would give a choice that's not available now to these residents and drivers. As you know, this road was picked as one of the worst in the country. Northern Virginia drivers say 82 hours a year stuck in traffic. We've got to find solutions. I do know that widening is a potential for this. There will be triggers in place that if the tolling and the enhanced multimodal does not work, then widening will take place. And I think it's a viable option, one that we believe we can get agreement from most people to move forward with.
Secretary, this is Tom Sherwood from Channel 4 News here in Washington. You know, the words Lexus lanes came to mind as you were speaking. You know, solo drivers who can afford to ride during the rush hour will pay a big fee. But, you know, the roads are supposed to be public. They're supposed to be available. What about the lower moderate income worker who needs to get to his or her job? They'll be stuck in traffic. They won't be able to afford the higher fees.
Well, again, if you're an HOV user, Tom, you're not impacted. And as a single driver, you're not allowed to use the roads today.
Right.
On top of that, Tom, I wish we were in a position where we had plenty of money where tolling and all the roads or other transit modes could be built. That is not the position we find ourselves in, neither at the federal or the state level. We've got excuse me, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me just ask you the controversial question. Isn't the problem Arlington, Fairfax, you know, saying stop, they wrote you a letter saying stop kowtowing to Arlington. It's obstructionist. It won't allow expansion of I-66. They're just the roadblock for this whole thing. Do you agree with that view?
Yeah, it is pleasurable to work on a project where everybody's in agreement.
Let me know when you get one.
Yeah. No, to say that there are every transportation project that I've worked on, there are compromises and political realities. And I don't necessarily mean Democrat, Republican. There are parochial, there are local realities. This road is in Arlington. We've made it clear that it has to be a real solution. They have not prohibited, Arlington has not prohibited widening up the road. Before we undertake this expensive project to widen, there seems reasonable to me to try these other multimodal options. But let me tell you, it's not going to be a negotiated. This is going to have very definitive triggers. And when these triggers fail, the deal that we have on the table, the road will be widened if these triggers come into play.
What, can I ask you, sir, if you widen the road, the people who come into the district, I mean, who come in towards the district on I-66, if you got more cars, more wider lanes, what happens when they come into the Washington immediate area, the bridges of the district?
Yeah, that is a great question. In fact, of this 10 miles, there's really only about four that really makes sense to widen, and that would be from the Dulles Connector on the west out towards Glebe Road or Boston. That would see some potential, but you're right. As you approach the district, this thing runs into a stoplight, and you can't have all these lanes running into a stoplight without having to merge. Plus, as you pointed out, retaining walls, I mean, actually in the Rockland area, that 29 runs right along the road. If you expand that, you're going to have to make compromises into that. There's a parking deck over top of it. Significant impacts to that if we were to widen. So it doesn't make sense from a transportation perspective as you merge in, other than there is a potential for this, as I said, about 4 miles during that stretch. And if this program does not give us the traffic flow, we're hoping this gets us up to 55 or 50 miles an hour 90% of the time. But you know what? If it doesn't, then that's going to trigger widening. And that's not going to be a negotiation. It's going to be a triggering based on empirical data.
Got to go to the phones. Joseph in Alexandria, Virginia, has some time on his hands right now because he is, well, I think, on I-66. Joseph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, how's it going, everybody?
Hi, Joseph.
Call in. So I got 2 points to make. The triggers, I feel like we're just kind of kicking the can down the street and waiting till, you know, this system does fail, until we do have to face, you know, the next page and have to make the road wider. We've seen that with the express lanes already in Northern Virginia, the foreign direct investment. You know, money's not really going back to the state. But my real question is, how bad does traffic get on 66 until you open up the restricted lanes that you monitor?
Arby Lane?
That is really based on traffic flow. And if you're talking about outside the Beltway, typically that happens around, we try to keep free flowing around 55 miles an hour. Inside, as you know, we never get. That road is not at those levels. What this plan would be is we would hope to attain 50 miles per hour for 90% of the time. And if it didn't, then that would trigger what?
Thank you very much for your call, Joseph. Here's Neil in Fairfax, also on the issue of I-66. Neil, your turn.
Hi. Good morning, Kojo, Tom, Mr. Secretary.
Morning.
I have a quick comment and then a quick question. My comment, something that Tom alluded to earlier. In theory, I understand the HOV is great in theory, but I do have a problem paying taxes for a road that I can only use on a limited basis. But my question is, it seems to me, in Virginia at least, that these road projects are more reactionary than proactive. In other words, we wait till the problem's too bad, then we do something. So, for example, if it turns out we have to widen the roads, in the multiple years it takes to widen those roads, especially in Arlington, more high rises, more apartment buildings will be built in the meantime, creating more cars, more traffic. So if we need to widen the roads, is there a plan that's only adjusted to how the traffic is now, or is it adjusted to the
traffic? Aubrey Lane, can you talk a little bit more about the larger regional transportation plan? I think that's what Neil would be interested in hearing about.
That's right. Absolutely. What we hope to achieve with this, and this is part of it, with 95 and 66 outside the Beltway, is having a regional hot lanes network that this would all connect to. And that would, of course, consider expanding it north on 395 as well. But I could not agree more that we have been reactionary, one, because of the amount of resources needed that we simply don't have in terms of putting these projects together. Let me just point out, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, we just have had our request. We have $7 billion in requests for projects across the Commonwealth. We have a little over $1 billion that we have available to meet those requests. So no doubt where we are reactionary. In terms of the land use part of this, that's another, again, multimodal solutions. If we can find ways to use the current infrastructure, the current footprint, before we widen, that's a better use of land use and planning, which means rapid bus transit, point-to-point, HOV, other types of transit. Those have got to be part of our solutions. No longer can we simply just put pavement down, although that is going to be a part of this solution also.
Thank you very much for your call. We're talking with Aubrey Lane, Jr. He is Virginia's Secretary of Transportation. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. If you have questions or comments for the Secretary, call us at 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org.
Mr. Secretary, you just said you really can't build your way out of this by just doing more traffic lanes, but isn't down the road, isn't I-66 future going to be something like I-270 with many more lanes?
Yes, particularly outside the Beltway. What our plan would be is to keep the existing three lanes or general purpose lanes, take the HOV lane, and convert it to hot with another hot lane. So you would have three general purpose and two hot lanes outside. And again, that was considered when we were looking at how we would deal with 66 inside the Beltway. And Tom, let me also point out, I mean, to put these projects in, that's a $2 billion project. We're going to have tolling to be a part of this for us to be able to afford it. We simply do not have the resources. Whether or not I wish we had them, that's a different topic. We simply don't.
The growth is faster than you can build the roads. Martin DeCaro, who covers transportation for WAM, you wanted me to ask if you would reconsider your decision to end the exemption for hybrid clean fuel vehicles on I-66.
Let
me just say to their listeners, they get to ride free now on the roadways, but they won't as you move towards toll road.
That's correct. But let me point out, Tom, whether or not this project moves forward, the hybrid exemption is going to end. When we first allowed hybrids on the HOV lane, we had to sign a binding agreement with the federal highways, with the federal authorities. And if any of those lanes are degraded by federal standards, then Virginia must take steps to limit and discontinue hybrid use in the HOV lanes, of which 66 inside the Beltway is an HOV lane. Parts of 66 are degraded near the Beltway where it becomes inside-outside. In 2011, Virginia stopped issuing the new clean fuel plates because the road is still degraded. And the feds are going to require an action plan for us to eliminate the hybrid exemption.
How many cars are we talking about?
Right now, I believe there are about 16,000 that are still remaining. How many of those use 66 all the time? I do not know. But regardless of whether I could get that, Tom, I just don't have the top of my head.
That's good enough. It's about 16,000 in the state still have them, whether they use them or not.
Yes, and so whether or not this project goes forward, that exemption is going to have to be dealt with because of the degrading of the highways.
We got go ahead, please.
I would just point out, and Virginia law requires that when you convert to HOV to hot lanes, that exemption be taken away.
We got an email from Alan Munchnick, president of the Arlington Coalition for Sensible Transportation. He says legislation filed for the 2016 General Assembly would prevent VDOT from tolling I-66 inside the Beltway. If that bill is enacted, would the Commonwealth commit to an alternative strategy such as expanded HOV2 with fewer exceptions to keep I-66 congestion-free during peak weekday commuting hours to move more people and promote ride-sharing and public transportation?
Well, first of all, let me say that obviously we would not be in favor of that legislation and we'll oppose it. I think as we lay the facts out, we're going to have a transportation board meeting in December, which they'll be open for public comment, and we'll lay out all this. I think most people think this is a very reasonable and practical approach to solving this. Yes, but to answer the second part of the question, that's got to be part of it, how we more efficiently use the road. If we have less resources, no tolling, that means if it were ever to widen, we'd have to take monies from other projects, which I've already explained was very, very limited. But any solution of this road has got to include a robust multimodal solution, HOV, ride-sharing, ways to use the current network more efficiently.
Secretary Lane, is I-66 the worst? Before you became secretary, you were in the Hampton Roads area, and you were working on roadways down there. And for any of us who've been to Hampton Roads area, we know there are discussions of a new tunnel, the roadways are jammed. Which is worse, the Hampton Roads area or the Northern Virginia area?
They're both bad, although I will say I-66 and the problems in Northern Virginia are constant. They are capacity issues. In Hampton Roads, they tend to be around the water crossings. But in Northern Virginia, it is really capacity all times during the day. And I think, quite frankly, you've looked at the number of hours in traffic, 82 in Northern Virginia where you're stuck, 38 in Hampton Roads, which is not good. But without trying to prejudge anything that may come out of our scoring process, I can't think of a more significant problem in the Commonwealth of Virginia than solving the issues on 66 and coordinating them with the other, hopefully the hot lane networks we're able to build around Northern Virginia. It's not only a regional problem, it's a state problem. I believe it's a national problem, and I think it has to be dealt with.
Speaking of national problems, transportation infrastructure in Virginia, as in much of the nation, isn't where it needs to be. What would you like to see? What are your concerns from your point of view as Transportation Secretary?
Well, certainly it's easy to say we need more funds. And I see where Congress appears they're going to, for the first time in a while, have more of a long-term solution, but they still haven't dealt with the chronic funding problems that we deal with. I'm happy that we found some monies, but it's simply not going to be enough both at the federal and the state level. Now, in Virginia, we recognize this. We got to take care of our current network first. So House Bill 1887 requires that the first 45% of all new construction monies must go to maintaining our current network because it's no sense continuing to add as we watch that deteriorate around us. I know we can always be more efficient. I'm all for that. I was in the business before this. Allocating capital and being good fiduciaries is number one. But to think that that's going to fix our problems, to think that the private parties are going to fix our problems without additional funding and the political will to do it, I believe we're going to continue to see a degrading of our infrastructure. So I have had a chance to be on Capitol Hill. We haven't been prescriptive, but what we need is a sustainable, multimodal, funding source that encourages growth in the system. But what we've done, we still need to do more.
Secretary Tom Sherwood, very quickly, are you happy with the new general manager for Metro, Paul Weidenfeld? Have you had a chance to look him over, and are you encouraged? Very quickly, please, sir.
I am encouraged, and I spoke with Paul yesterday. I believe it starts with getting the operations and safety. Got many issues there, but concentrating on that, I believe Paul will be successful. We in Virginia, Governor McAuliffe, we will do all we can to make him successful.
Thank you.
Aubrey Lane, Jr. is Virginia's Secretary of Transportation. Mr. Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I hope you have a nice holiday.
You too. You're listening to the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Joining us now in studio is Brian Frosch. He is Maryland's Attorney General. Brian Frosch, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Coach.
Tom, you just talked about Metro getting a new general manager. He has not yet, it is my understanding, theoretically signed on the dotted line.
Well, you know, there's always details. You always have to wait and wait. You know, he's supposed to come to work November 30th, I believe, right?
Yes, November 30th is the day he's supposed to come to work.
I think this we've gone beyond the period of time where he might back out. I think they're just working out the details.
Everything with Metro seems to take so very long to happen, and it would appear that the District of Columbia was supposed to have the next chair on the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority. Somehow that didn't come about, but as the saying goes, all politics is local. It would appear that that appointment fell to some local internal politics.
Well, it's important for all of us who use either Reagan National Airport or Dulles, that the place is run well, Nashville's doing well, Dulles is not doing so well. The chairmanship of the regional authority for that board changes every year, and it was the district's turn this time. But the leading candidate, Warner Session, wasn't in the position where he could do it. And the next person is Barbara Lang, and she was appointed by Mayor Vincent Gray at the time.
She made two mistakes.
Well,
she supported Vincent
Gray. No, there was only
Gray.
One mistake she
then
made.
Then she supported David Catania.
No, the mistake was, Barbara Lang was an open and strong and visible supporter of David Catania for mayor. Even during the campaign, after Bowser had become the nominee and was running against Catania in the fall, there were people who told me that the mayor, Bowser, inquired about how long was Barbara Lang's appointment and could she be taken off the board sooner than her appointment, and just told no, the appointment's for a fixed number of years. So that's the reason. I don't think the mayor wanted Barbara Lang to be
But she's
chairman.
Supposed to be on the board representing the interests of the district.
No, this is a regional board. I don't think who the chairman is makes that big of a difference. Maybe some staff issues. But, you know, if they're not working together, it doesn't matter who the chairman is. It's kind of like the Metro quagmire we're in.
Well, as we said, our guest is Maryland's Attorney General Brian Frosch. If you have questions for him, comments, praise, denunciations, call 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation, watch the live video stream, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Brian Frosch, the news at the top this week, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan made a request to President Obama asking that no more Syrian refugees be sent to Maryland. First of all, it's my understanding that about 37 Syrian refugees have been resettled in Maryland. You can correct me, but this is where federal and state authority intersect. What power does a governor have?
Not
to
very
refuse
much,
refugees?
Jojo.
Maybe none.
Yeah, I mean, once somebody has been admitted to the United States, and especially when the president has used his power to admit someone as a refugee, that person can go anywhere in the United States. The difficulty for many of the folks who are fleeing terror in the Middle East and perhaps elsewhere in the world is getting refugee status and getting into the United States in the first place. But once they're here, they can go where they want.
What about the political aspect of this? When people are afraid, this criticism of President Obama for not expressing acknowledging the fear of the country with what's happening with the Paris attacks and the fear of Syrians coming in. And several governors have urged some candidates for president on the Republican side have urged the nation not even accept any refugees for a while, close the borders. And I think one of them, I don't want to say which one, but one of them said maybe we should monitor mosques that are already existing now in other places where Muslims gather. It seems like we're in a really kind of a fear moment, and people are either not thinking rationally or they're just so afraid they can't think rationally.
I think that's right, Tom. Two responses to that. One is the great history of the United States is that we give refuge to immigrants. We're all, except for a few Native Americans, we're all the children of immigrants in this
Martin
country.
Martin O'Malley said this morning, I heard him on one of the shows, he said we can't turn the Statue of Liberty into to barbed wire.
Right. We have been a refuge for people fleeing oppression, seeking liberty, and fleeing for their lives. I think it would be a tragedy if we reversed that great history. The second point is that the folks who are admitted to the United States from the Middle East now go through a very rigorous, difficult process. And I think it's a little more than 2,000 nationally. And it's important to remember that I think something like 98% of them are children, women, and senior citizens. There are only a handful who are military-aged males. So the folks who have been admitted here, who've made it through the elaborate security process that's in place, are very unlikely to be dangerous. And I think it's just wrong for our country to say because there is trouble in the Middle East, because there is trouble in Paris.
Well, for those people who say because ISIL has indicated that it intends to try to slip people into this country under the guise of being refugees, what do you say to those?
And the vetting is not that good.
The vetting is pretty good. And I don't think we're ever going to be able to keep 100% of folks who want to do us harm out of the country. Some of them, you look at the European countries, the people who have engaged in the acts of terror are mostly folks who are the citizens of those countries. They're not the refugees.
Governor Hogan wasn't the only one. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, whom Hogan is backing for president, said he wants to keep all Syrian refugees out. And in Louisiana, Governor Bobby Jindal issued an executive order instructing his administration to use, quoting here, all lawful means to keep out Syrian refugees. Using all lawful means, what would be lawful in that context, if anything?
I can't think of anything that would be lawful. Once a person's lawfully in the country, you can't stop them from traveling to Louisiana or New Jersey.
The former presidential candidate,
I said,
Bobby Jindal, right?
I said presidential candidate Bobby Jindal. Well, it's only been less
than
a week since he's been out. So
no, days.
I keep forgetting.
Well, what Donald Trump, who's leading the Republican nomination, has said we need to monitor, possibly close mosques. You can't build a wall around the entire country.
Well, our Constitution prevents us, thankfully, from discriminating against people based on their religion or their nationality or the color of their skin.
Governor Hogan and others are concerned about public safety. How much of a risk do you think refugees potentially pose, especially given that news outlets report that one of the Paris attackers entered Europe posing as a Syrian refugee using a fake passport?
The last thing I saw on that, Kojo, was that it was a fake passport. They don't know who this fellow was. He may have been somebody who came from the Middle East, but he may not have been. And he certainly had a Syrian passport, but that's all they know at the moment. We've got plenty of problems in the United States already. We deal with gun violence at a level that is above that of most other industrialized nations. And I just don't think that the risks that are posed by a few people fleeing terror in the Middle East are going to dramatically increase the threats against us as a country or as individuals.
On a more domestic issue, the PEPCO Exelon merger is still pending in the District of Columbia. It's the last shoe in the centipede of people who have to approve it.
Right.
The Maryland Public Service Commission voted to have this PEPCO Exelon merger. You objected to it, and in October, I think you challenged to ask them to reconsider. I've lost track of where it is.
Correct.
Where are we now?
It's on appeal. It's got a ways to go in our court system. It's just at the circuit court level, but it's on appeal to the circuit court. The People's Council is pursuing that appeal.
And are you supporting that appeal?
I support that appeal. Quiet. We filed an amicus brief in that, although Judge said he was not going to consider it.
This is a huge issue in the district because there's some indications that Fresh Pack, the failed Independent Political Action Committee that was created for the mayor, is now being disbanded. May or may not have been involved. The opponents say that Exelon is an old line energy company that will simply just use the cash of Pepco for its own benefit and not be progressive in alternative energies. What was your objection, and is there any way, have you sought to make any, can you even make some inquiry into the D.C. Public Service Commission decision? They're going to be meeting December 2nd and 3rd, I think.
I think we'll leave to D.C.'s Attorney General, the very capable Attorney General.
He supports the revised merger.
Well, yeah, I mean, and we disagree on that. I think it's a bad deal. I think it's a bad deal for Marylanders. If you look at the benefits, the ratepayers in Maryland are going to get a little over $90 million. Shareholders are going to get about $1.6 billion. Depends on the values of the respective shares on any given day. But for the future of the electric industry in Maryland, it bodes ill, I think. Exelon has a huge nuclear fleet of power producers, and they have a huge incentive to push back against energy conservation, energy efficiency,
wind, solar,
and all the renewables. And that really has to be the future of electric generation in our country. Their incentives are all the wrong way, and to give them a monopoly that runs pretty much up and down the Middle Atlantic, I think is a grave mistake.
To put your hat on for the other side of the argument, if that is the case, and I've heard that from other people, other states where this is, that's the argument against it. Why are the public service commissions of the states approving it? What is the argument, if best as you can say it, is it an honest disagreement? Is it just the power of the power companies? What is it?
Well, I think there are a couple of things going on. First of all, they're used to saying yes to these utilities. That's the way it works. I don't think there's ever been a merger that's been turned down. And they're used to saying yes when they come in and ask for concessions and rate increases, et cetera. In particular, this one is troubling. It's the biggest one ever in our region. And if you think that it's important to rely more on renewables, rely more on energy efficiency, this is a merger that just doesn't do the right stuff for our ratepayers or for electricity generation.
The people who support this merger seem to be making the argument that, on the one hand, it's good to talk about the future in terms of renewable energy, but this is a deal that we are hoping will address the present problems that we have with Pepco, the present bills right. that our ratepayers are paying.
I think it'd be hard to find somebody who has a lower regard for Pepco's reliability than me. I mean, I have personally suffered in the winter and the summer for weeks without electricity.
Maybe you were targeted, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's quite possible. But what Exelon promises in this merger is what Pepco is required to do. They're not moving beyond what Pepco has promised to do and has been required to do by our Public Service Commission in terms of enhancing its reliability. So if you were concerned about Pepco's efforts, there's nothing in this merger that gives you any additional comfort. They're only going to hit the targets that Pepco is already required to hit.
Let me ask you about a nice thing that you can say something nice about. Senator Barbara Mikulski is wrapping up her career in the Senate. She's going to get the Presidential Medal of Honor next week from President Obama. I'm sure you're happy to hear that.
I'm not happy to hear that she's retiring. I am happy to hear that she's being honored. She's a great legislator, a great public servant. And she's served the people of Maryland very well for a very long time. When Senator Paul Sarbanes retired, I expressed my disappointment to him, and he said, you know, it's not a life sentence. So I'm glad for Senator Mikulski that she's doing what she wants, but the citizens will certainly miss her as a public servant.
Put on your headphones, please, because we're about to go to the phones where Sophia in Largo, Maryland awaits us. Sophia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have this question for Attorney General Brian Frosch. What are you doing to help homeowners where banks are concerned in the Largo, you know, Maryland, surrounding areas in Prince George's County? Homeowners are still combating foreclosure, whereby banks such as Bank of America are still, you know, unwilling to help homeowners, although there's been a settlement, or they've just are very egregious about, you know, their practices, still filing documents in court that are not, you know, adequate, affidavits and such. In addition to that, our courts are signing orders, phantom orders, without judges' signatures on it, which seems to me that's comparable to robo-signing. The signature is not decipherable, and they are signing orders to foreclose on homeowners' homes with undecipherable signatures. So what are your is your office doing to deal with this issue? And I've met with you personally, Brian Frosch, and I have also spoken with Lucy Cardwell in your office, and I have to tell you, you've been very useless in helping homeowners, in my opinion.
I'm sorry you feel that way. I was going to tell you that we do have a unit that works on individual problems like the ones you describe. If somebody has is in foreclosure, they think that the bank is doing something that's improper, illegal, my office can help. We try to help. The General Assembly and I was chairman of the committee that had this legislation, changed Maryland's laws. We had the fastest foreclosure process in the United States of America. We gave homeowners better notice, more of an opportunity to respond, and an opportunity to mediate with their lenders. And if the lenders are refusing to mediate, we can help with that. The balance was very much toward the banks before the General Assembly passed the new laws after the 2008 crisis. I think we have better tools to work with, but there are still problems, and Maryland is still experiencing higher foreclosures rates of foreclosure higher than its neighbors, in part because we slowed down the process in the wake of the financial crisis of 2008 with that legislation. But we are willing to help, and if you'll give us a call, we'll try to help.
Or in your case, Sophia, call again.
Yes.
Student loans. Debt for this population has now hit all-time highs. You recently announced an agreement with a for-profit education company to forgive loans for nearly 1,000 former Maryland students. Tell us about that and why you took that step.
Yes. EDMC, which is a company that has a number of different for-profit higher education companies, Argosy College, I think, or Argosy University, and several others settled with us and with other attorneys general across the country, and they agreed to stop misleading students. They agreed to refund money to folks all over the country. It's more than $100 million nationally. It's about $1.4 million that will be forgiven to students or people who enrolled in their courses in Maryland. And we find that it's been a problem with a number of for-profit universities, or these problems are similar to those of other for-profit universities, where they promise things that cannot be delivered. They recruit students who cannot qualify to get a job in the area in which they're getting the education from these folks. We are pursuing those that don't willingly ratchet back on the representations that they make that are enticing folks to do to enroll in their programs.
Name a couple of them. What companies are we talking about?
EDMC was
Kaplan.
That's the Education Credit Management Corporation.
Yes.
Okay.
And
If it's a list, don't worry about it. But are we talking about a couple? Are we talking about dozens?
There are a number. We're leading a multi-state investigation.
So they're all over.
Yes, and they're all over the United States and in Maryland and in the District of Columbia.
And would require federal legislation, maybe.
Well, we have good laws in Maryland. Our Consumer Protection Act prohibits the kinds of conduct that I've been describing. Some of these folks, I mean, more federal oversight, more federal laws would be welcome. The Consumer Finance Protection Board is looking into it along with the Attorney General's. Some of these for-profit schools have thousands of recruiters and very few, if any, job placement folks. So I would just say if you're thinking about spending money on higher education, check out the university, the college that you're dealing with, the career school that you're dealing with. Look on the Consumer Finance Protection Board's website to see what other folks have said about it.
Okay. Let me ask you, Prince George's State's Attorney Angela Alsobrooks was here within the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And she took a very hard stand on the easing of marijuana laws. She said that it's interfering with basic police work, where police officers can approach someone who has any odor or aroma of marijuana and through that check people out and find out they may have a gun, they may be wanted. She said she was really concerned. Where are you on what looks like an unstoppable move to make marijuana essentially legal in this country?
Well,
in Maryland.
Let me first say I think Angela Alsobrooks is a great law enforcement officer. She's done a great job in Prince George's County. I disagree with her on this one. I strongly supported decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana in Maryland. And we saw the effects of the criminalization of it, and they're not pretty. I mean, people spending time in jail, people who are otherwise not likely to commit harm. One story hit me particularly hard. It was a man who came to testify before our committee who said he got stopped. A police officer said he smelled marijuana in his car, handcuffed him, sat him on the curb for an hour, went through his car. He said, "I wasn't smoking any marijuana." But he came up with what he said was a speck of marijuana after the hour-long search, took him to the jail, booked him. He spent the night in jail, missed work the next day, lost his job, and 3 years later has yet to get back to where he was in his career at that point. And you see that played out over and over again. It affects
There's a racial aspect to it in addition.
I wanted to bring up the racial aspect to it because racial profiling is an issue you're trying to address in Maryland.
Yep.
It came up in our town hall discussion, Cojo and your community, that we held in Prince George's County on Tuesday. Can you talk about the idea behind Baltimore and beyond?
Sure. We did in August. We rolled out guidelines that prohibit racial profiling, ethnic profiling, religious profiling. It turns out we were the first state in the country to do that. We were following the lead of U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, who did it last December. It's not a radical move. It is what our Constitution and our state laws require. But if anybody doubted the need for it, they should have heard what our county executive, Ike Leggett, said when we announced it. He talked about election night last year, where he was putting up lawn signs at polling places, and a police car rolled up, officer popped out of the driver's side and started yelling at him, according to Ike Leggett, in terms that were abusive and inappropriate. And for those who don't know, County Executive Leggett is African-American. The other side of the police...
And one of the most mild-mannered people you'll ever meet. He's more mild-mannered than you are.
It's hard to do, but yes.
Which is hard to do.
He is. He's a very distinguished professor of law. The other side of the police car opened. A woman popped up and after watching what was going on said, "Oh, Mr. Leggett, please excuse him. He doesn't know who you are."
Well,
and of course, it doesn't matter who you are. what he was exercising his constitutional rights. So racial profiling is going on here. It's going on probably all over the country. We're trying to stop it in Maryland. I think
Given what just happened in Paris and the reaction here, some are concerned now about law enforcement profiling of people of Middle Eastern descent. Would Baltimore and beyond address all forms of profiling?
Our guidelines address all forms of profiling. Everything that's prohibited by our civil rights laws, that is, profiling based on race, creed, color, gender, religion, national origin, etc. And I think it's especially important to keep it in mind in light of what's going on in the Middle East.
Everybody, profiling is it instinctive? Is it prejudicial? Is it all of those things? Profiling is just what does that word actually mean for lawyers? That you are making an arbitrary judgment?
You're making a decision
judgment.
To stop somebody based on race, color, some yes.
You also launched a program to protect kids from identity theft. How might a child's identity be at risk?
Surprisingly, an identity thief would much rather steal the identity of a child than of a middle-aged millionaire, because they can use that identity for years without anybody being able to detect it. No 7-year-old is going to apply for an American Express card. And so it often happens that children reach the age of majority, apply for a credit card, and find out their credit's already been trashed. There have been more than 800 million breaches of personal data in the past 10 years. Almost all of us have had our identity compromised. Somebody filed tax returns in my name and my wife's name this year seeking a refund. If it can happen to the Attorney General, it can happen to anybody.
Wow. And how much money did they try to get?
I don't know. If I could say
very quickly.
Maryland allows parents to freeze the credit of their kids, and I recommend that for every parent in the state. Unless your kid needs a credit card at age 8, 9, 10, freeze their credit.
Sounds like good advice to me. Brian Frosch is Maryland's Attorney General. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. It's my understanding this afternoon we're on a mission, you, Mary Che, and I.
We will be fulfilling the promise.
The promise to get DC flag tattoos because a donor gave us $3,000. Got to come and take a look. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.